This is an interview with Kevin Westbrook, who has followed a career in tracking and other related fields and is currently retired. This interview is taking place today, the 14th of April, 1994, in Mr. Westbrook's home. Kevin, may we begin with how you came to join the space tracking industry?
Well, it's a fairly long story, so I won't bore you with too many details, but sufficient to say that my background at the time of joining the team at Mouchet, I was an installation supervisor with Telecom, or what, as it was known then, PMG, Postmaster General's Department. And I'd just finished a fairly interesting job and had been promoted, in inverted commas, to the office for as a reward. And being more of a hands-on merchant than a paper merchant, I guess, I was rather unhappy. And one morning, a friend of mine came into the office and said, "Hey, Kev, here's something that would interest you," and showed me one of the Commonwealth Gazettes, where they were advertising for people to join the space tracking station out at Mouchet. At that stage of game, of course, the manned space flight was very much very newsworthy, and the news was very, very hungry to find out everything about it. And of course, we, being rather technically minded, were also very interested in that sort of activity. So, without further ado, I brought out a pencil and paper and wrote an application which said basically I would like to apply for any job at the Mouchet tracking station that the following qualifications would suit me for. Listed all my qualifications, popped it in the post, and off, sat back and waited. And waited and waited and waited. And the grapevine was giving accounts of all the people that had been appointed, and there was still no sign of even an interview. And then one day we were called up for an interview, went through the motions, and finally finished up with the interview feeling, oh, well, I'd done as well as I could expect. And but we then waited a further 3 or 4, 5 or 6 weeks, still nothing. And then one day, a telephone call came. My chief in PMG said, "Hey," he said, "you've just been selected for a job out at Mouchet." Well, I was already travelling halfway to the moon when I heard this, because I was really enthusiastic about getting such a job. And we went through all the things that we would have to do, and because I was in the middle of it at that stage, by this time I was halfway through it installing another telephone exchange. So we went through all the mechanical bits of handing over and getting a new guy to take my position and so on and so forth. And after about half an hour of the telephone call, of this call, we were just about to hang up, and I said, "By the way, what sort of a job did I get?" And I was so enthusiastic about getting a job that I didn't even worry about what kind of a job. And if they told me that I was going to be a cleaners, I think I would have still taken it. But then I found that I was going to be the officer in charge of ground communication, air-to-ground communication, which meant the communicating with the satellite, ground communication, which meant getting the information back to the States, the time standard system, which was important in getting the information onto the recorders, make sure that it was time tagged correctly, and also the receivers and the command system, of course, which was a very important, vital part of the whole system, because it was through the command transmitters that the ground control was going to take over in the event of a problem occurring on the spacecraft. The next phone call I had was from Lewis Wainwright, who was the station director, acting station director at that time. He said, "I believe you're joining us." And we, after a few pleasantries, I said, "Well, yes, I'll be ready to start on Monday." This was Thursday. And he said, "What about Saturday? And I said, "Saturday? Yes, that'll be all right." So without further ado, we arrived at Mushe on the Saturday morning.
What was your transport? How did you arrive at the...
At that stage again, we had to drive to certain pickup points and leave our vehicles be there. We were always a bit concerned. I always adopted the policy that I wouldn't get off the bus or whatever we were travelling in until I could see my own car, because sometimes, later on when we got operational, we would be 3 or 4 or 5 or 6 o'clock in the morning, and the thought of leaving one's car just in a sort of a semi-vacant lot wasn't terribly attractive. I don't think we'd be game to do it these days. So off we went. When I got to Mushe, we found that the place was, there were people everywhere. And such was the confusion that there was no room for or time for briefing. I was given a set of what we called system tests, detailed system tests, DSTs. They'll remain engraved in my mind until I die. Mm-hmm. And we ran these DSTs on, I was doing some on the receivers, and some equipment which I'd never seen before, but nevertheless, we were used to that sort of thing, and away we went.
And there was the MUTs, the mercury tests.
Oh, mercury, yes, yes, the MUTs and DSTs and so on. We had, and but one funny story was that I was given a manila folder to take home to read, to give a little bit of a background. And on the front of the folder was the words H barrier. And I thought, oh gosh, what's H barrier? And I spent quite a bit of time thinking. I felt I can't ask this question. It's probably everybody would know what H barrier is. It's probably the heat barrier, because we knew that about the problems of re-entry, and I'd read something about the ablative shield, and I thought, oh, this... And the further I read, the more confused I became, and then I found little footnotes there. H barrier, H barrier. Everywhere I went, H barrier. About 3 days after I'd started out at Mushe, Lewis Wainwright came up to me with his guy, and he said, "Kev, I'd like you to meet the WECO installation manager, Herman Barrier." And I burst out laughing, and I said, "So you're H Barrier?" Just to put things in perspective there, although weapons research was responsible for the maintenance and operation of the station, the actual station installation was run under contract by the Americans, and Western Electric Company, WECO, had the contract to install the 16 Earth tracking stations. And so Herman Barrier was the man to whom we ran to when we had something that went wrong and we couldn't understand why it wouldn't work. He was a pretty nice guy, and we got on fairly well. Everything was done. This was just before Christmas. We were trying to establish at the same time as get everything going. We were trying to establish communications back to America. We had a teletype circuit and a voice circuit.
Because this was before the days of satellite communications.
Yes. Oh, yes. Mm. Well, we'll talk a little bit about that in a few moments. But communications, when one looks back on the kind of communication we have now, is every day. The communication which we had in for this first space shot was pretty crude. For example, the circuits between Perth and Adelaide. Yes, between Perth and Adelaide, and then of course on to Sydney and Sydney OTC, which was the gateway carrier, where we met the international carrier. That was between Perth and Adelaide, we had two 3-channel systems, 3-voice channel systems, and two 12-channel systems. So to serve the whole of the interstate communication requirements and a lot of the overseas requirements for Western Australia, we had something like about 30 channels, and some of those were taken up with teletype. So you can see that we were on a pretty damp piece of string, I think.
Real lean.
But to make matters worse, of course, there was no such thing in those days as microwave communication. It was all landline communication, the copper wire.
Valve systems.
Big pardon?
All valve systems.
Mm. But the main method of transmission, of course, was just copper wire. 200-pound copper wire. It was 200-pound to the copper wire was designated not by the diameter but by the weight. And when they talked 200-pound copper, we knew that it was weighed 200 pounds for every mile of copper wire. It's a single wire. But and we used to have a lot of outages because people were always running into these poles. They were always getting tangled up with galahs, the native wild birds. They would be feeding on the ground, and a car would go past and they'd all rise up in a flock and they'd get themselves all tangled up, and of course once they got themselves wrapped around the wires and the wires would wrap around, that was the end of the circuit as we knew it. But we survived, but it was hours and hours and hours of work trying just to establish the circuit between Mushe and Perth, which was, 40 miles. We can convert that to kilometres later. So, as I was saying earlier, we were right on the throes. People trying to establish the ground circuits. We were trying to get the teletype circuits going. We also had circuits. We're going to establish radio circuits, teletype circuits, out to the Indian Ocean ship, which was also going to be part of the tracking station network. And we had those circuits running out through OTC in Perth. And with the receivers were at Bassendean and the transmitters were at Applecross. And so we had lots and lots and lots of things to do. So we were working very, very long hours and very, very hard at that stage game. But it was great work, you know. Everybody had that feeling that we were doing something that was unique and something that was worthwhile and something which we as individuals were giving of ourselves. There were no computers in those days, so we just didn't punch commands into the computer and sit back and wait for something to happen. If it didn't happen, it was our fault. As we finally, the station started to take shape, then we started running tests. And, of course, when you're on a tracking station, tracking satellites, you really need a satellite to track. Because what else can you listen to? And what else can you get that moves at the right velocity or speed? And so they devised, they had a DC-3 fitted up by the RAF. It was a RAF DC-3. And they fitted it up with simple consoles which had a transponder in so that the Vilort radar could track it like as though it was a normal spacecraft. We had an air-to-ground comm, and so we could run checks on our air-to-ground transmitters and so on. It was, after a while, it became a little bit boring because, you know, you'd sit there and the plane would drone overhead and you'd go through your standard routine and then they'd go out of range and they'd come back and we'd drone through another standard routine. But whilst all this was happening, we had an American visit just from the States, and he came armed with scripts.
So all these tests up to now were devised by the station, they weren't devised by NASA?
Oh, no, they were. The tests themselves were devised by NASA. We had the system tests and the equipment tests and things like that, but what we had to do then was to start acting like a station instead of a whole lot of equipment, you know, right. Just doing their own little thing. And so he brought out some scripts. And I'd fortunately done a little bit of amateur theatricals at one stage of the game, so doing a reading a script wasn't any problem, but there were a lot of other people that had problems in sitting down and going through the script, because it was, everything there was, the I's were dotted and the T's were crossed, and it was M and O, this is GCC, we have data to line. And then the M and O would come and say, Roger, GCC. And after days of this kind of simulation and script reading, there were a lot of people that were almost ready to pack up and go home because they said, we came to do some technical work, not to be actors. But it wasn't very long and that we found that this kind of routine script reading and tests and things like that, and we're becoming much more used to it, of course, and we were totally happy. I'm trying to think of a good word here. We facilitated that the whole system came together, because you could not work without communicating. Unless you communicated effectively between each member of the team, then the whole thing would, and use standard procedures like Roger and Affirmative and Wilco and all the other space-age jargon that everybody used to laugh about. But once you used it, and people would often say, why do you use Affirmative when you could say yes? Affirmative seemed to be stand out so much more clearly, even though it took a little longer to say, than yes, and there was no way that you could misunderstand its meaning. And as this person, at one stage when there was almost a rebellion on his hands, he said, look, my job is to train all you guys so that you're going to do all the routine things without thinking. And there will be no, because you, there may be times when you may have a problem and you want to be able to concentrate wholly and solely on your problem without thinking what you should be saying or how you should be saying it or what you should be doing and so on. And I found this very much to my advantage later on when we had some quite hair-raising things to do. And I can remember one particular shot when Wally Schirra was involved and we had some antenna problems with OTC. And I'd been going at work for about 24 hours without a break. And I was sitting back relaxing And I thought, my God, we should be have acquisition time. And I looked at my watch and I thought, my God, I've missed the pass. And then I looked around and found that I had data to line, I had the iOS message had gone, everything was working smoothly, and I'd done it totally. I'd organised it totally without even thinking about it.
Yeah.
And it was great, you know. And then it was then that this person's words kept coming back to me. And I for the 21 years that I was with NASA, I always tried to pass on that information to anybody that I had working with me.
Well, that was the whole secret of the whole three projects. It was and the shuttle. It was the simulations.
Yes, that's right.
The practice, constant practice.
Oh, yes. We had a thing called computer and data flow integrated subsystems, and everybody said, that's a pretty big word, a lot of words to use, so everybody shortened it to CADFIS, because we always had these acronyms, and computer and data flow integrated subsystems. And these, in those days, we had two computers, neither of which would be up to the standard desktop PC these days, and it wouldn't be even a quarter of that capacity. And the programming was very, very basic, I think. And because there was no way that they could recover. They started off when we did a network simulation, and this was what CADFIS was all about, Computer and Data Flow Integrated Subsystem, meant that each tracking station came up on time, on cue, and sent a response to a computer-generated message. And when you got the message...
And that message was sent back to the States, right?
Yeah, we got the message from the States, from the computer in Goddard Space Flight Center. It would generate this send test 21. And with that little cryptic comment, we would then go through, and test 21 might be some biomedical data back from the FM-FM telemetry system. Test 12, I'm just trying to think of some of them. Test 12 was one that we were familiar with because we had to send 10 lines of Quick Brown Fox just to test the communication system.
The old teletypes.
On teletype, yeah, the old Model 28 teletype at 50 baud, and pretty slow by today's standards. But
and noisy.
And noisy, yes. And so, and one day, to my... I shouldn't admit this, but going back onto the CADFIS, it would go from Bermuda was the first tracking station, and then it would gradually advance around, and we'd get to Zanzibar, then it would come Indian Ocean ship. The iOS was always a bit of a worry because when they came up, they didn't seem to have too much of a clue of what to do.
And what was the iOS?
Indian Ocean ship. It was a tracking station on board ship, and they'd be bobbing around, I think. And they would send some kind of response, and then it would be Musha's turn, and then very shortly after that it would be Woomera's turn. And this, while all this was happening, of course, the communication links would be in and out. You know, sometimes you could never be sure when you had the communication links were in, because in addition to the open wire lines all the way back to Sydney, we then had a HF radio path between Sydney and Hawaii, and then from Hono, it went back to the States on their submarine cable. And then it traversed the whole of the United States, going through about three or four or five different carriers because there was no one single carrier. And so it was a bit catch-as-catch-can. But surprisingly, it worked well, and we, got through. But anyway, on this particular morning, we were battling along. It was about we had to start around about 5 o'clock in the morning.
Every Friday, wasn't it?
Every Friday, yes, Friday. Every Friday. And we arrived, got in, get everything warmed up, get going, and we were halfway through the CADFIS test. It would have been about 10 o'clock and everything dead silent, you see. And we waited and waited, and there was no way that we could contact anybody to find out just what the whether we had a problem or not. And Lewis Wainwright came to me. He said, what's happening, Kev? And I said, I'm not sure, but I think I've got a feeling that the lines might be out. And he said, well, what should we do? He said, let's wait for a few minutes, and if not, our next test was test number, I forget the test number, but we'll send a response to the next test. So we waited a few minutes, and there was not even a hiccup from the teletype circuit, so we sent test X, Y, Z. About less than 3 minutes later, Christopher C. Kraft.
Junior.
Junior. Opened up the network, and he said, Musho GCC, this is
flight.
And I said, go ahead. He said, do you realise what you've just done? And I said, no. He said, you've just completely destroyed our CADFIS test for the day. We now have to start back to Bermuda and go through it all again. So this was a worldwide transmission, so everybody on all the other tracking stations knew that the Musho GCC had really goofed. So I was feeling pretty embarrassed about the whole business, and of course the whole thing, everybody on this on the site at Musho were too happy because they were hoping to get away early. And so the thing dragged on until late in the afternoon, and of course it cost poor old NASA quite a few $1,000s to get this thing going. Anyway, I felt a little bit more relieved when we came up to do the next week's CADFIS. And we went through the thing, and this time I was determined that nothing would go wrong. And we played it by the book, and everything went by. And then I was very relieved that one of the other tracking stations, which I won't mention, did exactly the same thing. And Christopher C. Kraft, Jr., his voice was just about broke with anger because, you know, he then not only was cranky with me about destroying the test the previous week, but he said, you knew what had happened to Musho last week. Now, why on earth did you do it this week? And so there were some muttered apologies and things like that. But these were the sort of things we were learning as we went along, and we had a lot of fun going. Well, that was the CADFIS test, to end all CADFIS tests as far as we were concerned, to have that problem. Incidentally, I don't know, but I keep talking in acronyms here, so I should perhaps amplify the term GCC, because you'll hear it quite often, I guess. GCC was Ground Communication Coordinator, and that's when we talk about the MNO, he's the Maintenance and Operations Supervisor, and I'll try to explain the other acronyms as they come up. We were talking earlier about the fact that WRE and NASA had outfitted a DC-3 to run these flyby tests. And on this particular occasion, the aircraft had been held over at Pierce Depot, or the Pierce Air Force Base. And while we ran some supported the mission or ran some tests, can't exactly remember the reason, but we did hold it back just in case something went wrong. We could run some flyby checks to check out the equipment in real time. And once it was finished, they said, right, well, we're going to fly back to South Australia, the Edinburgh Air Force Base, that night and get there early in the morning. We were horrified when we came to work the next morning to hear that the aircraft had crashed on takeoff, or just shortly after takeoff, and had killed everybody on board. It seemed that the plane had just flown into a hill. There were some... we weren't involved with in the detail of just what actually happened and what caused the crash, but our understanding was that it was a little bit overloaded and it failed to gain sufficient height before it crashed into the surrounding hills. You know, we knew most of the guys on board, and it was a very sad time as far as we were concerned. And I'm not sure just how much is known of that, but this was really the first Australians that lost their lives in the, you know, for the NASA space program, I guess. Anyway, we, you know, when you're young and you're, you've got things to do, it soon becomes a thing of the past, and, you know, we still had a job to do, and away we went to do it. Our missions were, at that stage of game, they were trying desperately to get Enos, the chimp, off the ground and get him organised. And then somebody came up with a bright idea that what we needed was a Mercury Network Test Vehicle, MNTV. This was going to be the thing that was really going to try us out. And in theory, it sounded great. Here we had a spacecraft. It was going to emit all kinds of signals. It had a radar transponder. It did all this thing and was just going to orbit the tracking stations. Everybody would take data, and this would really give a live test. Poor old MNTV. It had more trouble than one could ever shake a stick at. We were finally convinced that it was going to rust on the pad, because every time it was about to fly, then there would be another hole and it would go. In the middle of all this, we were struggling with procedures, and we had a document which was called MG-102-15, Mercury General 102-15. Don't ask me what the 102-15, but it was a publication number. But it was the rules. They were the rules by which we were supposed to fly the ground communication. Unfortunately, it was put together by people who, they were service personnel, and they really didn't know too much about what went on in the real world as far as Australian communications or any other communications other than military type. And so it wasn't very long before we were all at sixes and sevens. And everybody was trying, but there were just holes, big holes in the documentation, which didn't allow too much to-ing and fro-ing. So I went to work one morning in the usual way. We had a car, and we were, it was a bus at that stage again. We arrived in this bus, and to be greeted by somebody who came rushing out to say, "You're on your way to the States." And I thought, ha-ha, somebody's having a lend of me, because there wasn't anything that I knew of that would take me to the United States of America. Man, that was a long way away. And remember, again, this was 1960-61. And so I went inside and looked, and there, sure enough, there was a message which to the MNO, the Maintenance and Operations Supervisor, which said, request that I, the GCC, be... go to the Goddard Space Flight Center and attend a communications conference. This communication conference was going to be a method by which we were going to get together and beat out a proper set of procedures, which later became as NASCOP, NASA Communications Operating Procedures. But to a young guy at that point in time, the thought of going to the United States of America was almost unheard of, and
In those days, everybody travelled first class, didn't they?
Yes, we all travelled first
right
class.
That was the,
yeah, that's right. Yes, yes. And much to the envy of the Americans, and just as a side issue of that, the Americans always used to, when later on I spent more time travelling over there, they would always try to arrange a trip to go wherever I was going, because they had a rule in their GS, their government service, that any person travelled with another officer would travel at the same status or the same level. So because I was travelling first class, then all the other guys would say, come on, we'll go down to the Cape or someplace, and they would tag along and they'd come first class as well. No one in the days when a dollar of ours was worth $1.32 in America, so you know, we were living off the top of the hog there. Anyway, back to our trip to the States. The whole thing was going to last 7 days. And 2 days travel, 5 days to for the conference, and then 2 days to get back. That made a total of 9, I guess, but they were talking 7. And so it was with great excitement. I went home and told Joan, my wife, that I was going off, and so we got ourselves organised, and away we went. Poor old Red Lake, the Woomera tracking station, their noses were out of joint a bit, because they said only one Australian, and they sort of nominated me because...
Musho was a bigger station, wasn't it?
Well, no, it was a sister station, but I think the reason why I was selected, or one of the reasons, was that we also had to worry about the Indian Ocean ship. We did the coordination there, and I had a lot more control over PMG, OTC, and general HF radio communication than whatever Woomera had. Woomera was an inline station, and we had the other people tacked onto us. So off we went. Well, I arrived at Goddard, and I can still see it now. The place was... buildings were going up like crazy everywhere, and we duckboarded across to Building 3, which was the main NASA Communication headquarters, and we duckboarded through. It was wet and sloppy and muddy, and we all finally finished up in this conference room, and we sat around and we started talking. I looked around and I found that I was the only non-American national in this group of about 50 or 60 people. And so I was considered to be a bit of a rarity. But nevertheless, we had plenty to offer, because whereas a lot of the guys were ex-military people, with my civilian-type background, they found it was quite useful, and particularly in talking to other carriers. So after 5 days of hectic wrangling during the day and partying during the night, I think one stage again I had 9 hours sleep in 72, but we were younger then, and we finally finished up with the basic text of NASCOP, NASA Communication Operating Procedures. And these, with very few modifications, became then the Bible for the whole of the network, right through to Apollo. Of course, they were updated as required, you know, to meet the different sets of circumstances. But generally speaking, what we thrashed out of that conference was quite important, and we certainly went back. And because everybody had met one another, and we all knew one another by our first names, and we'd sort of had a few drinks together after these grueling sessions, and we got pretty friendly, and it was like a big club. The whole of the communication system was like a big club, and you felt that you were really amongst friends, and that everybody then tried to help everybody else instead of trying to, take them off or take them down a peg or two. We all knew that if Ed was having problems, then you'd give him a call quietly when the loop was down during the non-mission period, and might give him a little test, send him a Twix and say, hey, this is what you ought to do. See, NASCOP page so-and-so and such, and they'd in turn do the same to you. So I then arrived back, and one of the interesting things about my trip over was that this was such an unusual occurrence for somebody to be sent to America, that we had to have all kinds of approval from, I think the Minister for Supply had to give his approval, but it certainly went to, if it wasn't him, it certainly went to a very high level. And I flew into a weapons research establishment, as it was then, in Salisbury, and was briefed by the Mercury, the Australian chap, I can't think of his name now, but who was the interface between NASA and WRE, and he briefed me on what I should be doing and what they'd organised and so on and so forth. And they said, of course, we haven't got approval for you yet, and the plane leaves at 5 o'clock, and if you're not on it, you're not on it. And so I did a pretty cold sweat there for a while, but just at the last moment, they said, came rushing down the passageway to the office where I was located, and they said, you're on your way. And with that, I jumped in the car and headed off out, and off to Sydney and over to America. What a culture shock that was. I don't think I talked to anybody for the first 5 days, and anybody I did talk to couldn't understand me, and I couldn't understand them, because the American vernacular was pretty strange and to the average American, particularly in those days, less used to hearing Australian voices than probably what they are now. Mm-hmm. And the taxi drivers would say, which part of London are you from, buddy? And you'd say, I'm not from London, I'm from Australia. Australia! Oh, and then off we would go, and they'd be asking about kangaroos hopping down Sydney's and all this about koala bears and so on. And it was all great fun. Anyway, on my return trip, I had to go up to Woomera, and I was feeling a little bit worried about going up to Woomera, frankly, because I knew that I was going to face a hostile audience, because they were feeling a bit blue that they missed out on, or one of their guys had missed out on a trip to the States and I had been sent instead. So I made very sure that I had a lot of interesting information and factual stuff to give them, and I found that people were professional enough that once they found that I did bring something back in my briefcase, then we all became very much the best of friends, and it was a great occasion. But that was the first trip, and one that I'll always remember. But poor old MNTV, it never got off the ground. They never fired it. At the end, they just scrapped that mission.
Who built it?
I don't know. I think it was built by Bendix. It was sitting on a pad down at the Cape, and it was just sitting there and sitting there and sitting there. And I think it'd be interesting to go back and start looking at some of the history books and just find out what they finally did with it. But I know it never got off the ground, and I think that probably they had to put an oxy torch through it to get it off the pad. So by this time, of course, we were getting pretty well set up to do the chimp shot, Enos, and we really worked very hard for that one, because after the first mission, which was a failure, and we were looking for poor old Enos, we didn't want to see him consigned to the same kind of fiery death as what the unmanned spacecraft went through, but also because there was a story going around that if it worked, it was obsolete, and we were a bit concerned that we were still, you know, in that testing phase, that it meant nothing would ever work. So, and then, of course, when the flight control team came out and we got our first chance to talk to the astronauts, the astronaut was the capsule communicator, and he led the team, and we had, I can't recall all the names of it, except that Warren Bishop was the doctor, the aeromed. He was...
That's the Australian.
He's an Australian, mm-hmm. Yes. And he was from the an Air Force doctor, nice guy, and everybody, you know, in those days, we all wore flying helmet and goggles and things like that, you know, theoretically, of course, but it was great to be alive, you know, great to be involved in such momentous activity. And we went through all the sims for Enos, and when it came the night of the launch, I said to Joan, my wife, I said, I think I'll take some bananas in to put on the control consoles. Because, you know, if these guys are going to be communicating with a chimp, they better start thinking like a chimp. So I went
down. So that was your original idea?
It was my original idea. I bought a bag of bananas. I think Lewis Wainwright and looked at me a little bit worriedly, because he was he had a fairly straightforward British
conservatism,
and but I found that one of the best ways in which to relieve some of the tension was to just lighten the load a bit, because you sometimes, I think for all of us, we were living on really, as I said earlier, on the knife edge, and we were expecting things to go wrong. We really didn't know what was going to happen. We worried that it might be our fault, and that was the sort of thing that stayed with me everywhere. It couldn't be our fault, you know, and it just a wrong decision, or split second pause or a problem with communication, which, you know, as far as I was concerned, which prevented a message from getting through, a critical message, could have really caused a lot of problems. And so, you know, you wind yourself up pretty well. And I found that by doing things like putting bananas on capsule communicators consoles, and they got a laugh out of it, everybody relaxed. Just dropped the throttle back a couple of notches, and I think it was appreciated, and we all had a bit of a laugh.
Actually, Wally Schirra mentioned it later in a book.
Yeah, Wally.
In good terms. It wasn't him at the time, but he mentioned it. So obviously it made his mark.
Made his mark, yes. Well, they were such lovely, big, yellow bananas, and we had plenty of those later when we went to Carnarvon, but they were nice bananas. I didn't even get to see whether they ate them or not, and I didn't even really get to see what their reaction was, because I was too busy getting my own system in order. And this was one of the things that we soon developed, an awareness of what was happening to all the other systems while you were listening to the loop, to make sure that they weren't having any problems. The thought that was uppermost in your mind at all time was, is everything going? And, you know, what were the communication paths like? Because, you know, you can... Not much went wrong with the actual equipment on site, because, you know, after all, it was pretty reliable. But it was the intangible thing. The moment it hit our mainframe and disappeared down the cable on towards, or the towards Perth, then we never knew whether it was going to get there or not. And we had some fairly funny things happen. I think that if we just talked about communications, PMG, as it was then, Postmaster General's Department, and which I was on loan from, they gave unswerving support throughout the whole of the 20-odd years that I was associated with it. And I would say without reservation that I was proud to be associated with people such as those guys. And we had a particular corner which was on the way from Perth to Kalgoorlie, and there was a bad corner on the road because the open wire lines followed the main road all the way along. And this corner seemed to be very hard to take, particularly if you were over 0.05, and in those days there were no such things as breathalyzers. And people would fail to negotiate the corner and then take off the pole. And the first thing we'd know about it, of course, is the teletype would then start to garble and or may go right out and things like that. And this was what happened one night. We were doing a simulation. I think got a feeling it was for Enos. And we were going pretty well, and the next moment communications went down. And we were in real trouble because being at the end of the line, our first call was into Perth to contact the people that did the troubleshooting, the line troubleshooting. Then they would then have to go all the way along across Australia to determine whether it was in Australia or, and of course, obviously the first point of call was OTC in Sydney to make sure the signal was leaving them, and if it wasn't, then it was back here somewhere, back between Sydney and Mushe. Anyway, after a while, we found that it was this suicide corner where somebody had gone round the, and snapped the pole at the base. And while the circuits were still going, they were just actually the medium by which they were supporting the pole. And so I had a call from them, and they said, well, we'd like to repair this thing. And I said, how long would that take? And they said, oh, well, I reckon it would take about, 5 or 6 hours. I said, 5 or 6 hours? We can't afford that time. Can't we do something else? And there was some consultation at the other end. They said, well, maybe what we could do is get the linesman to prop the pole up. They had long poles, which they called pikes, poles with long spikes at the end, and they prodded these into the pole as far up as they could, and they kept this pole upright right the way through the mission. They even had a team of linesmen camped there, and it was freezing cold. It was in the middle of winter, and I really felt sorry for these lads, but that was the kind of thing that they were prepared to do. We had many more, and there'll be many more instances as we go along, but that was one of the first times that we had. It wasn't very long after that kind of mission that we had more problems, and I suggested that we had an order wire, and this was a fairly costly thing, but we finished up with an order wire which tied all the PMG points of interest, those people that could help us, all on the one network, together with the tracking station at Mushe and the tracking station at Island Lagoon, and OTC at all the other spots. And we were all sitting there on this loop, and we used to, by this way, I could control, because I was the one at the other end and Sydney was at the extreme end of it, we could then get very quickly on to isolate the problem, and we could also pass this information very quickly back to the States, and they would know whether they had to put a hold in the system or whether we could live around, work around it and so on. So it became quite an interesting...
So you're talking a distance of about 3,000 miles from...
Yeah, 3,000 miles, and that was open wire line, and it was all,
a lot of the wild desert country.
Yes, that's right. But worse was yet to come. But anyway, that was the thing. We then, of course, once John Glenn's flight came into view, and after Enos splashed down, of course, we had a party for Enos. But unfortunately, he wasn't able to attend. I don't know whether he'd have appreciated it anyway, but most of us acted like a bit like a few monkeys because we were letting our hair down. But when it came John Glenn's time, I'm just trying to think now of the moments that led up to it. In one way, it was like a normal day because, as one of them said afterwards, one of the Capcom said, "My, that was the easiest simulation we've had." And really, when you've simulated with some of the horrible things that they were, you know, they throw at you during a simulation, and you'd lose communication or you'd lose pieces of equipment and so on and so forth, and all of this was aimed at trying to get your reaction time or your response time down to the bare bones minimum. And so that once you really went into a mission, and we had an arrangement with PMG and OTC of a thing which we called critical coverage. And critical coverage really worked on the basis that if it works, don't fix it. And we worked on that basis that everybody flew hands off and gave us total priority for the period of time that we went into mission period till the time we finished or time we had splashdown. And during a non-mission period or during a simulation where we were simulating with the network, we would then have a condition called special coverage. These were things which were brought out at this NASCOM conference, and it was agreed upon by all and sundry. And it was magic because majority of problems in communication links always occur by people having a little tinker, and if you could keep their fingers out of it, then things used to work a lot better. But anyway, so on this particular day that we're starting to get organised, I'm trying to think desperately. I know that it was rather enviously called by the other people the comm car. I had a Commonwealth car, station wagon actually, and because I was always supposed to be the first there to get the communications up and running and to be the last one to leave because we couldn't leave until we closed out for the night, and quite often that would be 3 or 4 o'clock in the morning while we were trying to re-establish contact to say, "Hey, we're going home," because we couldn't go home until we told them we were going home or we're allowed to go home. But anyway, got in the car and we drove the 30 or 40 miles out to Mieche and arrived. Everybody who came in, you could see that there was an air of expectancy because we'd had our holds and our sims and everything was going, but somehow it just felt right this time. And we got in there and we busied ourselves getting all the equipment up and running and running checks and tests and making sure our backup equipment was working and everything. We double-checked, treble-checked everything, the intercom network. And I talked with Jerry O'Connor. He was my 2IC. He was the comm tech. I'm just trying to think of the name. Communication technician. And there was some discussion initially when we both arrived. The communication technician or comm tech position was a bit of a prize plum because it meant that he was an Australian going to be, you know, directly involved in the link between the astronaut and ground control. And but it soon sorted itself out because it was obvious that Jerry was the person in charge, or he was responsible for the HF and command air-to-ground transmitters. And while I was supposed to be in charge of everything, you know, my big responsibility was the ground communications, and it was pretty obvious that where we both fitted best. And although I must confess that I felt a bit regretful that I missed out on being a comtech, my common sense immediately got the better of me and said, look, I'm a lot happier in one way worrying about the problems that I know about and then sitting in at a console and with a responsibility just to talk to the astronaut and feeling that maybe there were other things happening which I could better give my expertise to. Being, as I said before, more oriented towards ground-type communication or long-line communication rather than HF radio, although I had some experience in that. So we were all settling around, and we had a little room, just the TNC building, a telemetry and command building at Musha. It was just one long basic shed. It was lined, it was air-conditioned, but it was still that, just a shed. And it partitioned off. Each area had its own separate area. But there was one common eating place where we all gathered around to have our meals. Of course, it was very much do-it-yourself kit. You took your own sandwiches and coffee and made your own. And so once we got ourselves organised, we all broke off, had our coffee, discussed at length. The Lewis Wainwright kept going around to us all and checking us to make sure that we were all ready. And then around about a couple of hours before we went into the actual launch window, or the launch period, the flight control team came along. They were in the habit of, they would sort of wander in at pretty close up, read the Twixes. Twixes are teletype messages that stands for Trans World Exchange, but everybody called the messages Twixes. It was just one of those things. Read the Twixes to find out what they had to do, and then pretty leisurely get themselves organised. Of course, we'd done all of the hard work, and we had the all the switches thrown, and all they had to do was sit down and go.
Now, what were you hearing from the States?
Oh, I was
down the line.
At that stage of game, of course, voice communication was pretty sparse. They would go around and do a voice check every 15 minutes or half an hour just to make sure that the stations were on board, and they had to get a status check from the MNO, and the MNO would then come around before a couple of minutes before the stat was due to go down the pipe. He would call everybody in turn, and we had a standard roster of doing that. He would start off at the Vallort radar and get a status. And we all kept our fingers crossed that there wasn't going to be anything red. Red meant that we had some equipment problems, and I think on several occasions minor things were happening, particularly in the telemetry, because in those days, of course, there were no transistors, were not
common.
Not common, yes. And we had everything was done by vacuum tubes. And I think back on those days and wonder how we ever managed to fly a mission at all. In the time standard, for example, I think we had something like 40 tubes providing all the outputs, necessary outputs for the tape recorders and such. And you lose one of those and you lose an output. But now and again you get this red status, red. And there would be a flurry of excitement, and you'd provide an ETA of how much the length of time it would take to fix the problem. That would be relayed over the voice pipe down to, or over the scammer circuit. Scammer stands for switching, conferencing and monitoring arrangement. There's some of these words, you know, they sort of have their origins lost in time, I guess, but they... nevertheless, they described the system pretty well, the scammer. So you'd send a call down the scammer to say, hey, where the radar is red, ETO, such and such a time. And you could set your clock that if you said ETO in 5 minutes or 10 minutes or whatever, in within a few seconds of that 10-minute time being up, the MNO would be down checking to find out what was going on, and also... flight would be on the pipe to say, on scammer, to say, hey, what's your status, Mushe? So it just kept on going, and we all did our bit, and we were all pretty subdued, I think. We were all very much conscious of the problem. Here we are, we were going into a system where we did have a man's life at stake, and we were obviously quite concerned that everything was going to work out okay. As the countdown proceeded, you know, of course we had many holds, everything, we'd just be going down there and you'd get within a couple of hours of liftoff, and then you'd be holding because there was some problem that had been located which hadn't been uncovered during the simulations. By the time that we were getting close to liftoff, of course, even by the time it was getting pretty dark, and we had outside toilets. To get there, you sort of... There was no outside lighting. It was the lights were all off because we were worried a bit about RFI, radio frequency interference, and so everything was kept down to a minimum. And so you had to find your way out around there. Of course, we'd been there before, you know. But I had to go off the loop and go to the toilet. And I was heading off around the corner and I ran into a kangaroo coming around the other corner. And headlong, I tell you what, if I jumped about 10 feet in the air and the kangaroo did likewise, you know, and we sort of, but these were the sort of things that were pretty, they weren't uncommon to have kangaroos, and the same sort of thing happened. I'm not sure whether it happened to one of the flight controllers, but it certainly happened to quite a few of the others, because the kangaroos would come down, and they would, particularly in the cold, and they seemed to come close to the building because of warmth, or they'd smell something. But that was one of the highlights, I think, of the John Glenn launch. I nearly went into orbit myself. But... when it came down to countdown, of course, we got down and we'd had a few holds right up. And to lift off, and you'd get within about 5 minutes and they would hold. And then they would double-check something and then they'd pick up the count again at 10, liftoff minus 10 minutes. We got down and finally... it got to liftoff, and we all held our breath at that stage again, because we have a liftoff, and then it had cleared the tower, and then
it was on its way.
It was on its way. It was really on its way, and we sort of looked at one another, and we couldn't really believe it, and remembering the basic. Problems that we had had of 30 seconds after liftoff, this thing had disintegrated. We were held our breath through that period. And then we had capsule separation, where the spacecraft separated from the booster and was now turned around and was flying backwards, of course, and it was on its way. And then the problems became more localized because you then started worrying about your own equipment as to whether it was all going to work. And I can still hear Ken Lee down at the Vallort. Ken Lee and Don Blackman were down in the Vallort radar, which was being about a quarter to a half a mile away from the main building in a van. And the acquisition aid people, of course, got the signal first. And they said, M&O, this is ACK aid. We have a signal. And that was really snapped us to attention because, you know, we thought, my gosh, it's happening. You know, we've got a real signal. It's not the DC-3 flying overhead, but it's a spacecraft. And the next moment, Vallort came up and said, Vallort has track. And at the same time, I got a green light on my radar data control unit. And I came up with the radar data online. And the next moment, telemetry, of course, came in. They had signals and everything was starting to work. And the flight controllers busied themselves with chatting. And once they got in contact with John Glenn, they then started uplinking a lot of data and information that had come in previously on the teletypes.
Because your Capcom was Gordon Cooper, right?
Yes. And Gordo was uplinking the stuff. And they then had to go through a procedure of setting their... I think they were setting their gyros or... But it required a very precise effort. And I can't for the life of me just think what it was. But all I can remember was just listening to the chat and thinking to myself, my gosh, that guy is, he's actually in space flying almost overhead, and was sort of wondering about it and listening to Gordo and John chatting away as though nothing was happening, you know, and it was just like a simulation. And, but I well remember that after the end of this rather intricate procedure where they finally did their job, Gordon Cooper called up to John. He said, "Well, there it is." He said, "We're right on." And he said, a little bit later, there was some more exchange, and he said, "Oh yeah, well, it's good enough for government work, but," he said, "for you, it's right on the money." And you know, you all had that feeling that you were together. And you had your hands out to this guy. I don't want to sound too melodramatic about it, but it's something that would never, ever, I don't think anything else would replace it, you know, short of getting up there and flying this darn thing. You just felt like you were a member of a big team and that you were all giving everybody a helping hand.
Of course, Jerry Connor is supposed to be the person with the first time that anybody ever spoke to an Australian spoke to a space traveller.
Yes, that's right. As I mentioned earlier, Jerry was the comm tech, and you know, we discussed also about the fact that it was a rather prized location. So naturally enough, seeing as Jerry and the air ground links were under my, in inverted commas, supervision, I was naturally enough not only interested to hear how it all went from a technical viewpoint, probably even more so than on the actual historic moment of Jerry being the first person to, or first Australian, to talk to a man in space. But in hindsight, I can mentally picture the words coming over on the loop, the air ground loop, and he made the usual opening comments, made contact with the astronaut, with John Glenn, and after only a few more words, he handed over to the CAPCOM, the capsule communicator, who then went into his went into his act. But it was, I can remember listening to the voice as it came up over the hill, as everybody being over the horizon is probably a better way of putting it, because we were probably not quite so used to having communication on such a line of sight basis, and it was really curious, because when they first made the call, there was this weak signal, and it seemed to grow, well, it did, it didn't seem, it grew stronger by the second, and after the first interchange, and after Jerry said over, when John Glenn came back first, of course it was very weak and very shadowy, and I thought, oh gosh, that's not very good comm. And I was worrying about the receivers I phoned, and then the next moment it was booming in, and I was really pleased about that. But it was a great moment, you know. We, as I said earlier, all this, everybody in the team getting into it. So, anyway, we were all pretty busy, as you can well imagine, that there was, it was traffic coming inbound from the States, and everybody was working, and the capsule communicator was chatting away, as I said earlier, to John Glenn, and the M&O was constantly checking to make sure that everything was working all right, and my main concern was the radar data, which went out in teletype form, and to see this great stream of data going down the line. And I had my fingers well and truly crossed that I was going to get the other end. But, of course, an eight-minute pass depends. Sometimes it went quickly and other times it went very slowly. But this it didn't seem very long before it was over, and we heard Red Lake come up and say, we have AOS. And my main immediate concern was to try to get the status messages from the flight control team back over to the States, and sometimes they were a little bit tardy because they want to chat about all the various things which probably to the flight control team back in the States would be pretty uninteresting, but to them was pretty vital. And anyway, their part in the mission had been done. But our part was still to go arrive. We had a long message which we had to type out, and our own personal pride meant that we couldn't be behind the Red Lake team in getting our traffic to line, because that would have been the stone-cold bitter end, because the blame would have come straight back onto the ground communications team, because the flight controllers would say, well, we've done our job, you know. And so there was much pacing of the floor and snatching of paper as soon as it came to hand, and tearing little bits off and giving it to the two teletype operators that we had, trying to get it to line in time.
What, the radar data was sent out by hand, was it?
No, radar data was sent by hand, okay. But all the flight control console data, of course, we didn't have the luxury of being able to send it over data streams. Data at that stage was, and we used to think how marvellous it was, that the once they got into AOS, and after they chatted with the spacecraft, they would then put biomed data to line.
Right.
And that was analog data, which just went over and it was pretty slow. But to us, it sounded pretty high tech.
Biomed and things like heartbeats.
Yes, and respiration rate. And all that. But that was pretty essential stuff. if there wasn't any, then there would be a bit of concern, obviously. Anyway, we finished off that orbit, and by this time we were feeling pretty happy that we'd been blooded and we'd come out okay on the first round. And then the second and third orbits came and went, and with more of the same, and we really felt pleased. Our next moment of concern, of course, was when they fired the retro rockets and they made re-entry. The heat generated by the spacecraft flying through the atmosphere was so intense that it completely ionized the air surrounding the spacecraft. And so we went into a blackout condition. And of course, when that blackout condition occurred, they completely lost contact with the astronaut, and nobody was very sure as to that point in time whether the spacecraft was lost or whether it burnt up completely. And I know that we certainly held our breath, and from the comments that we heard on the loop from back in the stateside, they were also holding their breath. But the next thing we knew, that the drogue was out and the main chute was deployed and it was swinging on the end of it, and we all breathed a big sigh of relief. So that was the first. That was the first manned orbital flight. We'll get back. And in retrospect, it started, it was an easy simulation because everything went well. And we, as I said earlier, had some pretty horrendous tricks played on us by the SIM team. They send these special guys. I think they came straight from hell, really. They came out with all these bad ideas, of how they were going to trip us up and find our weak spots. And we were quite concerned that, we could be found wanting. But I well remember our first network simulation that we had. And it was tied together and scripted so well that I became convinced, it sounds crazy, I know, but I became convinced in my own mind that they'd done the dirty on us and they'd actually let something go. And it was, I went off the loop and I went down to Lewis Wainwright. I said, Lewis, are you sure that this is just a simulation? And he said, it's very realistic, isn't it? He said, I'm not sure. He said, how can we find out? And he was half convinced. And we sort of became more and more, as it turned out, this whole thing, I guess it was a matter of becoming caught up in the system. And, this was our first simulation, our first network sim. We'd never experienced anything quite so realistic without the real thing flying. It was our first thing. We didn't even know what we were going to experience. There'd never been anything floating around. And we were... It almost appeared to me at that stage that we were, probably almost semi-hypnotized, you might say, by the fact that here we were doing something that was pretty... unusual. Everything was happening in real time, and Bermuda came up and started reading throughout all the data. Incidentally, they used to record the data and play it back so that the consoles did really come to life. And both the Capcom console and everywhere, it looked as though it was real. And when you heard these voices come up and say, Bermuda has AOS and this and that and something else, and they were giving readouts or what, it didn't take much prodding for anybody that had a fertile imagination to start thinking, hey, there is something real up there. And I know that both Lewis and I were quite convinced for a matter of about 10 or 15 minutes that there was something going to happen. And I know that there was a quiet telephone call made by Lewis down to the Vallorte radar, which said, hey, make sure that we play it for real this time. And and I know my reaction on the M&O loop, the on the main control loop, was pretty excited. And I call out in a very loud, excited voice, "Data line!" And at the end, after the simulation, there was a special mention. Chris Kraft came on the circuit, and he went round to everybody, and we had this normal debrief, as we had when we were game with John Glenn. But after every time they brought the network together, we had a big debrief and highlighted all the problems and the terrible things that other people did. But Chris came on the line and said, I want to thank all you people for your great support, but in particular, I want to pay a special thank you to Musha for the great support, their enthusiastic support. And I thought, you don't know half it. That enthusiasm was just about too much. But getting back to John Glenn's flight, me, of course, by this time we were really seasoned veterans, and we went through the business of debriefing, cleaning up. Again, waving goodbye to everybody, the flight control team fled, and pretty quickly after they'd done their bit, and then all the other team left, and I was left with a teletype operator and I can't think of the name of the policeman. We had a security policeman, an Irishman, Jim McQuaid. And Jim McQuaid came, and the three of us were standing around, and he had a very broad Irish accent, you know, and we were chatting about this whole thing. By this time, it was getting pretty early or pretty late, whichever way you look at it. And I was feeling pretty tired, I know. And I was with a bit of a sigh of relief when we got the message back from the States that we were released from the net, which meant that we could secure all the circuits and then go home. And we were then hopped in the car and drove the other back home, and I think it was about dawn was breaking somehow. I can't even remember the time we got home, but it was getting pretty early, and I crashed into bed. Joan, my wife, said, "How was it?" Of course, she'd listened to it. She said, "Oh, you know, how was it from where we were sitting?" And we discussed that for a while. But there was no rest for the wicked, because we just had to get a few hours sleep and then get back to work and start cleaning up the mess, because all the traffic that was there.
Ready for another catfish.
But,
Kevin, we'll have to call it a day, because we're coming to the end of this particular tape number one, and so we'll pick it up again on another tape later on.
Great.